Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. On the program today, a hate crimes bill continues to advance through the state legislature, but its sponsor says he's not celebrating just yet. Plus, a look at the bill to ban so-called conversion therapy in Utah and the city of Sandy's water woes. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune senior managing editor Matt Canham. And good morning and welcome, Matt.
Good morning.
Also joining us is reporter Taylor Stevens. And thanks for being here, Taylor.
Good morning, Roger.
And columnist George Pyle. Greetings, George, and welcome to you.
Good morning.
Listeners, you are invited to join this conversation. You can post your questions at sltrib.com at the Behind the Headlines page that's currently live, or you can tweet us. We're at KCPW, or call 801-355-8255. We have started every show for the past few weeks with the legislature. Let's kick things off instead today with a story about the city of Sandy's water supply. And Taylor Stevens, maybe we can start at the beginning. Last week, a pump malfunctioned at a water treatment plant for Sandy's water supply, some of Sandy's water supply. What did that do?
So that kicked on a fluoride pump that then pumped too much fluoride into the water. And too much fluoride has a couple of effects. One, it can make you sick, gastrointestinal problems. Two, it can acidify the water, which can corrode pipes. That then leads homes that have older pipes to kind of also get copper and lead into the water system. So some homes were dealing with kind of this trio of, you know, fluoride, copper, and lead in their water, drinking water, and that they were unaware of this for, you know, around a week before some homes actually heard.
What were sort of the effects for people, you know, who were drinking the water?
Yeah, they had gastrointestinal problems. That was kind of the main thing. What the city has said, health experts have said, that they don't expect any of these people to have long-term health impacts, but it definitely wasn't fun. And for a lot of them, you know, were not able to really pinpoint the cause of their symptoms and kept drinking the water.
Does the city say the water is safe to drink now?
The water is safe to drink as of Sunday. Now the tables have kind of turned to talking about how did this happen? Why was this allowed to go on for so long without people being notified? And what can the city do in the future to ensure it has better communication with residents?
There's a bit of, not political fallout, but Sandy's public utilities director is now on leave as a result of this.
Yeah, paid administrative leave. And he said that he'd stepped down because the media pressure was keeping him from doing his job. So we'll see what happens with that. That's kind of in the interim while the city conducts an independent investigation into the water issues. And the city council voted unanimously to approve that on Tuesday. Basically, what they want is a trio of experts to look into kind of what happened and the response from the city. So while that's going on, the public utilities director is taking, again, a paid administrative leave.
Matt Canham, water woes in Sandy as a result of a power failure and then sort of the fallout as a result of that.
I think there's a lot of frustrated residents, and it's in part because of this really slow response. It took almost 10 days before they said, hey, maybe we shouldn't be drinking the water.
And some residents said they still hadn't been notified up to the day when the no drinking order was lifted. They still hadn't received any notification from the city.
And this is part of the public utilities director's fault. He's taken the blame for part of this. They sent crews to walk through what they thought was the affected area, which they now admit was too small of an area. And they went door to door. And when someone didn't answer, they didn't leave any note or anything. They just said, well, okay, we'll try again another time, even though those people had water that could be contaminated. One of the things that people should think about when this is that Sandy says their water supply is safe. But if a massive amount of fluoride hit your pipes and your pipes are older, you're going to have an individual effect in every house.
Right.
So if you had older pipes, you might have more lead in your water than, say, your neighbor who had them replaced a few years ago. And so that's why they're asking still to have volunteers go house to house to check the water. They did release some more information yesterday that of a pretty significant number of houses, only one still had a problem. But they're still testing, and they still want to test.
Do we know why initially they thought it was fewer? I mean, why they went door to door? Matt Cannon points out that it was they went to just a few houses or 100 houses. I don't know how many numbers, how big that number was, but then it turned out that the number of houses was in the thousands. Why was there that? How did they not know?
Part of it was because they say they weren't receiving complaints from residents. But again, it can be difficult, you know, when you're experiencing symptoms. Maybe this was the Chinese food that I had last night, or, you know, it could be any number of reasons. And so just in the fact that they weren't receiving complaints isn't enough to kind of rule out certain areas. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely, I think, part of it. But yeah, there's a lot of frustration from residents. There was a town hall on Monday, which was kind of unusual because it was President's Day, where resident after resident came forward and expressed a lot of frustration. Tuesday, the city council meeting, we saw the same thing. So I think residents, you know, they just want to move forward and know that their city, they can rely on to provide them with information that they need moving forward.
Part of what this did also was to reawaken a debate on fluoride in the water supply. Taylor, can you tell us about that debate? I mean, it involved some members of the Salt Lake County Council.
Yeah, this is really interesting because if you kind of rewind a little bit, the Salt Lake County voters approved fluoride in their water in 2000. It was a ballot initiative that passed, I think, by 58%. And so the fluoride in the water was implemented in 2003. And since then, I mean, there's probably a lot of residents today who don't know that their water in Salt Lake County is fluoridated. It hasn't really been a topic of contentious conversation over the last, you know, 18, 19 years or so. But with this incident, a lot of people are saying, hey, wait, is this something that we still need to do? Should we take another look at this? Among those, Salt Lake County Councilwoman Amy Winder Newton, who I think has some concerns about her water being medicated, she says, without a lot of people's consent or knowledge. And she advocated for, you know, maybe we should take another look at this, put this back on the ballot. Maybe in 2000, people weren't receiving as much fluoride, but now I get plenty through my toothpaste. She's not the only public official starting this conversation, but I think is notable because she is, you know, on the county level where this mandate occurred.
Happens. Yeah. Fluoride is beneficial in small doses, right, Taylor? I mean, it's in our water supply to provide a benefit, a dental benefit.
Right. Salt Lake County Health Department says that it's worth noting that we've never had a problem with this in the over a decade this has been in our water. And so they don't want one bad incident to kind of throw all of this into question. They say that and it helps with teeth, especially for children under 8 and for adults, can help strengthen the teeth, their adult teeth.
I'm going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet us at KCBW with your questions and comments. The poisons in the dosage, they say, any number of otherwise beneficial products in excess can be bad for you. Vitamin C even can be dangerous. But these were dangerous fluoride levels that were coming into the water supply as a result of this power failure, right?
Yeah, exactly.
George Pyle, Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor and columnist. I want to bring you on this conversation, and I don't want to make light of this, but sometimes when we hear people expressing concerns about fluoride in water, we might jump to this clip, which I'm going to play, that I know you appreciate because you wrote a column about it. This is from the 1964 Stanley Kubrick movie, Dr. Strangelove.
Have you ever heard of a thing called fluoridation? Fluoridation of water?
Yes, I have heard of that, Jack. Yes. Yes.
Well, do you know what it is?
No. No, I don't know what it is now.
Do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face?
George, that's General Jack Ripper, who in Dr. Strangelove is, you know, off his rocker. It seems early for Dr. Strangelove, but I couldn't help myself there.
Well, Stanley Hayden, Peter Sellers, can't go wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, just, the reason we play that is because if people of a certain age or people of a younger age who really like movies cannot hear the word fluoride or fluoridation without thinking of this movie, without thinking of this scene. And the reason that it matters is because it's just an example of back in the 50s and 60s, You had the John Birch Society. You had McCarthyism. You had everything was a communist plot. There was a commie under every bed. People were being thrown out of their government jobs and out of the army because they wore a red tie or something, and that meant they were a communist. And it was just everywhere. And it became kind of a touchstone for liberal, open-minded people to dismiss these conspiracy theories, including fluoridation. So if you were against fluoridation, you were some kind of a kook. You know, only General Ripper and the John Birch Society is against fluoridation. Everybody, all the intelligent people, are for it. And so the argument kind of ended, partly because of the satire and the humor that was poked at people who were against that. Well, you have an incident like this, and there's been some conversation about it over the years, and maybe this movie and these jokes are old enough now that we don't think about it anymore. But putting a chemical in the water supply for a healthful benefit, I mean, the Centers for Disease Control is still all for it. They say it's one of the 20 best things that happened to health in the 20th century. But it's like you're being involuntarily medicated. And you didn't consent, and your children certainly didn't consent. In many cases, you don't even know it's happening. And as is demonstrated here, if it isn't done exactly right, it can cause all kinds of problems. And even if it is done right, there are people who have sensitivities to things. And so it might be worth going back and hopefully having a rational conversation as opposed to talking to General Ripper about whether putting a substance in the water that everybody is then forced to drink or cook with or bathe in or brush your teeth with is really a proper role of government. And if you're going to do it, you know, you have to be extra careful because the mix is crucial. And this, I mean, this gets down to the fact that, you know, we talk all about, you know, the border and international trade and all this stuff. What affects our daily lives is local government plowing the streets and protecting the water supply. And that's what really is the day-to-day most important thing.
Did Taylor Stevens, going back to you, did Amy Winder Newton, who's on the Salt Lake County Council, I mean, she suggested a new referendum, or was it a sort of, didn't she kind of back off her comments eventually?
She did. I think that her comments on social media were maybe a little bit stronger. And when I talked to her, she sort of seemed to want to open a conversation about this. So she told me, I'm not necessarily advocating for anything. I just think that it's time to have a conversation.
And it gets down to, again, it's just management of these things. I mean, what in Flint, Michigan, where, you know, they still have the problem they had, nobody put poison in the water in Flint, Michigan. They went to a different water source. It was more acidic. And so the lead and the heavy metals in people's water is because it, like as in this case, it leached out of old pipes, whereas with the previous water supply, it didn't. So as the evolutionary biologists I used to know always say, you can never do only one thing. Anything you do is liable to have all kinds of unforeseen ramifications down the way that you had no intent of doing.
Consequences of minor actions. Taylor, just getting back again to the water supply problems. This is, again, safe to drink. It's considered safe by the city of Sandy. And what else is happening in terms of preventing something like this from happening again? There's this investigation underway, correct?
Right. And I think that the investigation is really going to provide some direction for how the city will manage future crises. So I don't know that we know what that looks like yet, but they definitely want to present to the public that they're taking this very seriously, and they're going to take steps to remedy something like this from happening in the future.
All right. Let's take a quick break on the show, and then we will turn away from the city of Sandy and to the legislative session and some bills that are making their way through there. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, reporter Taylor Stevens, and news columnist, actually columnist, George Pyle. Join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com, or tweet us at KCPW. Matt Canham, let's turn now to a story about hate crimes. There's a bill that is trying to address or enhance or actually create hate crimes legislation that will have teeth in the state of Utah that is making its way through the state legislature. Where is that piece of legislation now?
It has passed. A Senate committee is going to the full Senate, and this is significant progress for people who want this law to be enhanced and strengthened. For years, the legislature has debated. I mean, years. I mean, probably close to two
decades.
Since
2016, most recent iteration.
The most recent iteration. But they've been talking about hate crimes for a long time. And so the latest one is just changed a little bit to expand the number of groups that would be included. There are things you think about, sexual orientation, disability, religion. They've added the school that you go to. Hmm. So the Utah BYU fight could potentially become a hate crime if that's why you attacked someone.
Does that exist in any other state? I'm just curious. Do we know?
I would be very, very surprised if that was. They also added a law enforcement status so that if you went after a cop, it could be considered a hate crime.
I don't know. After the Duke. In North Carolina game the other night, there might have been some violence in the stands.
Senator Daniel Thatcher said that he was very excited to get on the playing field, but he was not taking a victory lap at this point. He knows there's a lot of political lift. And this is a story that Taylor has written a lot about, setting up exactly what's behind this fight and the role that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has played.
Right. They're not opposing this deal or this bill this session. In past sessions, they've kind of taken they've weighed in and said there's a compromise deal that they're trying to protect.
And so that was kind of initially they had weighed in and said, let's hold off. And then in 2017 and 2018, the church stayed neutral. And Senator Thatcher argued that neutrality was being viewed as opposition by some members of the legislature. So this is the first year that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has come out and said it is not opposed to the hate crimes bill. That was seen as a pretty big move this year. There have also been, as we've talked on this show before, some pretty high-profile hate crimes cases in Utah, in Salt Lake City, especially over the last few months, that may be contributing to kind of giving this a little bit of a push. But this is the first time that the bill has received a hearing since 2016. So we'll see what happens on the Senate floor.
Utah's existing hate crimes law has never resulted in a successful conviction. It's been criticized for being weak. What would this do that is different than the current statute? And what does hate crimes legislation actually accomplish? Is it about enhancing the level of crime? Are you moving from, say, misdemeanor to felony, or is it about the penalties you receive for doing the crime? I don't know who wants to answer that, Matt or Taylor.
Yeah, so as Matt talked about, what this iteration of the bill would do is it would enumerate the people that would be protected under hate crimes. The bill that passed in the 90s, first kind of creating hate crimes, there were disagreements about who should be protected and how that should look. And so they ended up passing something that didn't outline groups, that it didn't say who should be protected. And what we've seen since that law was instated is that makes it really hard to protect anyone with this law. So what this is doing is enumerating the protected groups. To your second question, what hate crimes looks like, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about this. You have to be charged with a crime first. So say you committed an assault. You'd have to be charged with an assault, and then a judge could consider a hate crimes penalty enhancement on top of what you would already receive as your sentence. So in the case that we had recently at Latino Tires in Salt Lake City, that man, as he attacked this son and his father, he shouted, "I want to kill a Mexican." And so that is kind of the direct evidence that you need under this provision to charge someone with a penalty enhancement. You couldn't go back, as I understand it, to, say, 2011 Facebook post where someone had said they didn't like Mexicans and enhance a penalty based off of that. There has to be a really clear tie between the action and the words, whether that be spoken or on Facebook. So if you posted on Facebook, "I'm going to go attack, you know, a Mexican today," you can see that's pretty tied, right?
Are judges, I mean, when they're doling out punishment, are they not taking those factors? Are they not taking that into consideration now, or are they just less? Are they reticent, I guess, to take that kind of language into consideration when doling out punishment?
I just don't think that the law defines the protected classes, and they just, the way that the language is written prevents prosecutors now from taking that into consideration.
The current law only focuses on misdemeanors and is toothless. It's never actually successfully led to an enhanced penalty. Prosecutors, law enforcement are behind this bill. They know that there are instances where there is a hate crime that deserves to get an extra attention. And the idea is, the philosophy behind it is, that certain crimes have broader implications. If you are one of the Lopez family who got, you know, beat with a metal pole at their tire shop, that assault happened and that's a horrible thing. But it scares an entire community that someone would come after them because of their nationality. And that's a different level. And that's what they're trying to get at here. The debate against this, you have someone like Gail Ruzicka with the Eagle Forum, a very conservative group. She's long been opposed to this. She's currently opposed to this. She says right now, everyone's treated equally under the law. An assault is an assault. And that's just the way it is. She says this creates winners and losers. So yes, if you were a disabled person who had something bad happen to you, that could be able to be enhanced. But Gail Ruzicka, who might get grief for being a conservative political figure, gets attacked and that wouldn't, because that doesn't fit under the threshold.
And Senator Thatcher says everybody has a sexual orientation, everybody has a nationality, everybody has a gender. And so while it may seem that people who are part of minority groups are being attacked, if you shouted, "I want to kill a white person," then you'd be protected under this as well.
There's a federal hate crime statute as well. And actually, I'm just going back to the story of the Lopez family that you brought up, Matt Canham. The person who the perpetrator of that crime, who went out and said the language that he used and then attacked this family, he's being charged at the federal level with a hate crime, is he not?
Yes. His name's Alan Covington. He's 50 years old. He's the one that is believed to have done that attack. He's the one who is charged with those crimes. And because he's charged in state crimes as well, but they brought it federally because there is no hate crime option on the state level. That's why there are these federal charges. If there were state charges, it probably would have stayed on the state level. But they thought this crime was egregious enough that prosecutors, including Sim Gill, moved it to the federal level to try to get that enhancement.
Okay. What do we know just generally about the prevalence of hate crimes in Utah? And are they on the rise? Have we seen more of them?
The data has really been squishy. We had a hard time this year. The FBI put out hate crime data that made it appear as if there was a significant increase. When we talked to some of the law enforcement agencies who apparently saw that spike, they said the numbers were wrong. So I would say it's about static. There's about 70 hate crimes that the FBI accounts for in a year. We had some recently that could fall into that group, including an assault of a gay man on Main Street in Salt Lake City that was recorded by the victim, recorded it and put it online. That's still being investigated, but it was an assault that, according to this 8-second video, started with the attacker asking the victim if he was gay. When the victim said yes, he got hit. So that could easily fall into this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The Salt Lake Tribune is partnered with ProPublica to try to get a better sense of hate crimes. And so we are taking a pretty significant look at instances in Utah where this might be a factor and pray to be part of a broader national network to get better data on this.
And you're soliciting feedback from readers on at the bottom of this hate crimes article that I was
right. Reading. And the reason that we do that is that we keep an eye on the criminal justice system as well as we can. But things change and more information comes to light later sometimes that we might miss it in those immediate breaking moments, but that it was something that should be considered under this umbrella called hate crimes. So we are asking people that if they know of an instance that we haven't reported or if they were involved in one, unfortunately, that they'd let us know so we could try to keep track of these.
Okay. George Pyle, editorial voice at the Salt Lake Tribune, hate crimes, you know, the current statute doesn't appear to have teeth. It has, you know, nobody's been successfully prosecuted under it. This bill is now, you know, further along than it's been at any recent legislative session. What do you think?
Well, the Tribune editorially and myself as an individual, we hope it passes. We think it's a good idea. We try to make very clear to people that even though we call it, and I think, you know, branding is everything and it's too late to change it, but you shouldn't. Calling it hate crimes is really stupid.
It's worth noting that the bill's sponsor would rather everyone called it victim targeting legislation.
Okay, well, that's better. Probably the better term for it is terrorism, because that's what it is and that's why anybody cares. The reason anybody cares that this is not just assault or murder or vandalism or arson or something like that and can be treated with existing laws is that by targeting a particular person, you are targeting a whole group of people. And yes, Gail Rozicka, people could decide that they hate white Mormon women and go beat up one, and with the intent or the obvious side effect of making all white Mormon women feel fear because it happened to her, it could just as easily happen to me. And that's the point of this person staging this attack. So if you call it what it is, which is terrorism, instead of hate crime, because when you call it a hate crime, say, well, you're criminalizing a thought. You're criminalizing an emotion. Don't tell me who to hate. I'll hate who I want. Well, yeah, you'll still hate who you want as long as you don't cross what was already the threshold of a criminal act.
That brings me to the idea of how do we know – what do we know about how much of a deterrent a hate crime is against other crimes? Do we have a sense of that, either Taylor or Matt? Does it prevent crime, or is it just about, punishment?
Right. So the hard part with any sort of criminal code asking whether it's a deterrent is that the answer is no to all of them. There's punishment for theft. It doesn't stop people from stealing. That's the same thing here. But it does send a message about what a community thinks is important and about protection of groups, which is what the advocates would say. It also, when people have a broader intent, and it's a broader criminal intent to scare a community, that should deserve punishment and should be looked at differently than something that was, while itself bad, was of more limited scope.
Yeah, it's a more serious crime. I mean, we have gradations of all kinds of crimes. We have A felonies and B felonies or class one or whatever they call it. And, you can get charged with murder and it can get pleaded down to manslaughter or get pleaded down to assault or they can come back and charge something more if more evidence comes up. We have gradations of all these laws. We have intent measured in all these laws. Did you mean to run this person over with your car, or was it an accident? So intent is in a lot of our law. It's not just in this one.
Sure, involuntary versus Matt, this bill, just even getting a hearing, as we said, is a major feat for proponents of hate crimes legislation. How far has it come? How much further does it have to go?
So that was the first step, and it's the biggest step in the sense that many people believe the LDS Church is reluctance to say anything, and at least the understanding that they were quietly opposed, had stopped this from moving at all. This is now going to the Senate floor, where we expect it to be a pretty close vote. The Senate president said he's in favor of it, which I think is a signal that it might eke through. He hasn't always been in favor of these kind of things. So then it goes to the House, where I think it probably is an easier run there than it is in the Senate. So I think the next vote or the next series of votes will be the key part.
Determining factors here. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on it and probably talk about it in the coming weeks as well. I want to turn to some other bills that are out there. And a number of states, 15 states actually, have banned a practice known as conversion therapy. This is where a therapist tries to change a person's sexual orientation. Lawmakers here in Utah yesterday unveiled a proposal to make the practice illegal here in Utah as well. Matt Canham, what does this proposal say?
So this has been a debate or a negotiation that's gone on for months. Equality Utah is the one who's behind this. There are two conservative lawmakers who are carrying it. The conversation has been, once again, with the LDS Church, because in Utah, that's where conversion therapy has really happened, is where Latter-day Saint youth tell their relatives that they have same-sex attraction, and their parents push them into therapy to try to change their sexual orientation. This is a tragic thing that has happened for years. The church has disavows it now, says it shouldn't happen, it's a bad idea, but it still does happen. And this would be a bill that would ban it for minors. And it does have exceptions for clergy, so that if they said something, it wouldn't, you know, fall under this. This is for licensed therapists. Bethany Rogers, who wrote the story for us, starts her story with the tale of Nathan Daly. He's now 19. He grew up in Lehi. When he decided he was gay and wanted to, he went to see a therapist. This therapist told him he should start bulking up, being more muscular, playing more sports with guys, wearing manly clothes, and that every time he had a gay thought, he was supposed to snap a rubber band against his wrist. And there were days he did it so much that he'd bleed. It obviously didn't work. He became suicidal, and he made it. He was at this news conference as an example of the dangers of this kind of therapy. And the trying to get the statistics on the number of people who go through it is a little hard, because therapists don't advertise themselves as conversion therapy. But so you're doing it as surveys of LGBTQ people and asking how many of them have done it, which is also kind of a hard thing to nail down. But what is clear is that the studies that have been done show that an increased risk of suicide for those who have actually gone to this kind of therapy.
It's been condemned by a lot of organizations, American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, Pediatrics. There's a lot of groups that have come out against it. The LDS Church says, I mean, they're basically on board with this. They're saying we haven't. This isn't a practice that we're engaged in, and we think it's a damaging practice as well.
Kind of like with hate crimes, they're saying this is one where they don't oppose, but they're not putting their stamp of approval on it either. We have a new president of the LDS Church and a new lobbyist in the former House Speaker, Marty Stevens. So we're still trying to get comfortable with their rhythm of political involvement. But I do think that not opposing is the essentially saying that, they are totally fine with this one going through. And with two conservative lawmakers and the church, this has a decent chance of happening.
It's only just been introduced as legislation. Nothing has happened to it yet. It has to get a committee hearing.
It's going to go through the whole process. But this is a pretty strong start.
George Pyle, Utah potentially joining other states in banning this practice. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we've editorialized in favor of this. We think that they should do this. It just applies to minors. So if you're an adult and you think you want to go to conversion therapy, the law is not going to tell you can't. You're going to find fewer and fewer counselors who are going to be offering this service because it's basically fallen out of favor. And the psychiatry profession has said, no, being gay is not an illness or a malady that has to be fixed. So don't try to fix it. It's no point. It doesn't work. And even if it did work, it's just interfering in somebody's personal life. It's none of your business. So it's going away. But the threat is with minors, because either their parents or their church leaders will say, oh, God, that's horrible. You need to go get fixed. And now, with some exceptions now, for if you have church leaders who still want to say that, well, you shouldn't be gay, being gay is bad, they can still say this because that's not therapy. They're not licensed therapists.
All right. We'll keep an eye on this one as well. And we're going to just head to one more break in the show here. And when we come back, we're going to stick with some further stories from the state legislative session. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the local programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news recap from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, George Pyle, and Taylor Stevens. You can join us with your questions and comments. Again, the number is 801-355-8255, or you can tweet us at KCPW or post your questions at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Let's turn to other stories from the legislature. And, Matt, there's a bill to institute something called Lauren's Law, named after Lauren McCluskey, the University of Utah student athlete who was murdered on campus by an estranged ex-boyfriend who had been lying about who he was to her, basically. What would Lauren's Law do, Matt Canham?
This bill is sponsored by Representative Andrew Stoddard. He's a Democrat from Sandy and new to the legislature. And what his bill would do would allow for the ability to sue someone who lent their gun to someone and it was used in a crime. So the connection to Lauren McCluskey's death is that someone gave Roland a gun, and he used it to shoot Lauren and then used it to shoot himself. And Lauren McCluskey's parents have said that person who lent that gun should face a penalty for it, should know that the person they're giving their gun to, for what purpose, they should be held accountable for the actions used with their weapon. Now, that doesn't happen in our law. The police are not going to do anything in that circumstance. They did not. That person did not know about Melvin Roland's criminal history. So they said there's nothing to do. What this bill would do would allow for a lawsuit against that person. So it wouldn't be a criminal thing. It'd be a civil penalty. It got a hearing in a House committee that was not excited about this idea. This was the House Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Committee. It was challenged by the National Rifle Association with a slippery slope argument that this would set firearm owners up to be targets of litigation in an already overly litigious society, was what their lobbyist said. And so it was shelved for the year, but with the caveat that there might be something here. Even some of Utah's conservative lawmakers on this committee were open to seeing if there was some version of this idea that was willing to bring back next year.
Weren't there actually two measures that were related to this, having to do with creating a crime or a penalty for loaning out your gun at the Capitol?
Well, so this is the one that was tied to Lauren McCluskey. There are other safety and proper storage of guns. This is more of an education thing and an encouragement. Also, rebate on bio. What's the right term? Use your fingerprint.
Yeah.
No, the smart guns?
Metrics.
Biometric safe. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And this was Steve Elias in an attempt. This is mostly about suicide.
Okay.
Where you could have a gun safe where it's your fingerprint that opens it. So that, let's say you're at a house with someone who's struggling. You can put that gun in a safe where that other person couldn't get into it. And he's displayed this in many public settings. Trying to convince gun owners that you can still quickly get your firearm if you wanted it for home safety.
So the bill, though, that was called Lauren's Law. I mean, as you said, it's been held and it's done for the entire session.
It's done for the session. I mean, this is one of the things about Utah session. It's 45 days. So if there's any sort of significant concern on the first hearing of your bill, unless you can strike a very quick deal, you're trying again next year. Which is why lots of bills take multiple sessions to get through. If Andrew Stoddard, this is obviously his first time running this bill, and he did get some encouragement that there might be a way to draft this that gun owners would be okay with. Whether they actually strike a deal, I mean, we'll see.
George Pyle, you're an editorial voice. You're a columnist who is free to opine on things. What do you make of this opposition to that bill?
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, anytime anybody comes up with anything that would indicate that people who own firearms have some responsibility for what is done with those firearms, and they go, oh, no, you can't hold us responsible for anything. We're white males with guns. We can do anything we want. And so it's just, it's frustrating. It's happens all the time. This is a new idea in this state, and I don't know of too many other places that have it. I don't think it's totally unreasonable to say, let's hold this over and let's talk about it some more. But I think there's a real fear that this is just a way of shunting it off until everybody's forgotten about the crime, you know, the very high-profile crime that got everybody interested in this.
All right. You know, the show, we're going to get close to the end of the show here, and we'll have to turn to underplayed stories here before too long. Matt Canham, I want to, just before we do that, get some updates on legislation having to do with restricting abortion in Utah. There are two bills. One is an abortion ban after a specific number of weeks. This is Representative Cheryl Acton's proposal. What's the latest on that one?
So that passed the House committee, but only on a 7-5 vote, showing that there is some opposition to it. She changed it from 15 weeks to 18 weeks because she believes that will have a better chance of surviving a legal challenge, which will most definitely come.
And there have been concerns about the cost of that legal challenge as well. It had its first committee meeting on Wednesday, and now it's on to the floor for the House floor for debate there, right?
That's right.
And then the other bill that I mentioned, this is a revived proposal from last year by Representative Carrie Ann Lisenby, having to do with just tell us what it would do, Matt.
This is about banning abortions when the sole reason to get it is Down syndrome. And this is this has been a pretty emotional debate that they've had at the Capitol. And I believe that one passed the House and is now moving to the Senate.
And the idea is that a prospective mother would have an abortion for the sole reason, or for the specific reason that the fetus had been diagnosed with Down syndrome.
Right.
And that would be outlawed.
Yeah. And this is something that has been struck down in other states. This is something that came up last year. And it's, you know, there's still the same sort of challenge.
Okay. Taylor Stevens, before we close out the show here, I want to turn to some reporting that you did on the Utah Inland Port. There was legislation also, obviously at the state legislative session this week that has to do with monitoring environmental conditions at the Inland Port. I'm sure most people by now know what the Inland Port is, but maybe just a quick refresher as well as you lay out what this legislation would do.
Yeah, it's a distribution hub planned for 20,000 acres on Salt Lake City's westernmost area. It hasn't been kind of fully formed yet. They're still planning a business plan to map that out. What this bill would do is set up some monitors to monitor air quality, sound impacts, water quality, all of these impacts that might come as a result of that massive development. That's really been the big argument from opponents, is that this is going to have a big environmental cost to it. And so this bill, run by Senator Luz Escamilla, she says is her number one priority for this session. Her district is over the areas of the Inland Port, which is in part of West Valley, Magna, and, like I said, that big chunk of the westernmost side of Salt Lake City. So it passed out of committee with favorable recommendation. There are some concerns about the fiscal note on that. There's some cost associated with, you know, putting in the monitors, maintaining them with the Department of Environmental Quality. But Escamilla, who has served on the Appropriations Committee, says that getting that financing is a lift she's going to be able to make happen, or going to work as hard as she can to make happen.
Mm-hmm. I know that the Salt Lake City School District has expressed concern about pollution around students who are living near to where the port is going to be built. And as you said, other environmental groups are concerned about just the level of emissions from increased truck traffic. This is just barely cleared to committee, is that right?
Yep, cleared to committee and is moving on to the Senate floor now. And, you know, I think we forget that people, well, obviously they can't forget, but I think when we think about this area, we think of undeveloped land, but if you're not in this area, you might not realize there are homes here, there are already some businesses here, and so this is going to impact not only those people, but the entire city is what they're concerned about, and, you know, how can we make sure that we know what the impacts are? So this would really create a baseline of what is it like in the area now, so that once the development starts growing, we can understand, has it had an impact?
What is the, how is the baseline determined? It's just there's environmental sensors of some sort, air quality sensors, I guess, probably?
Air quality sensors. And I know that the Department of Environmental Quality has said, I don't know that it has the ability or has done in the past these sound monitoring or the light monitoring. So that's something that they might have to kind of, what's the word, freelance out, maybe contract out. And so that'll be interesting to see. But basically, they're not only concerned about the people, but also about the birds, the wildlife in this area. So they want to see how is that impacted by the sound and the light as well.
If and then if they determine as this inland port is being built and develops that there are, I mean, is there... It's just monitoring. This is determining baselines and then seeing how change happens. It's not prescriptive in any way after that.
No, it's okay. Not.
All right. George Pyle, I left you out of the last stories that we talked about. I'm sorry about that.
No, all right.
It was an accident. But on this inland port bill, to try and establish a baseline understanding of how it's affecting and impacting the environment.
Yeah, I mean, as important and as concerning as air quality is around here, I mean, we really don't have the modern monitoring systems that we ought to have, I think. I mean, just if this was a movie, we'd have sensors all over the place with all kinds of real-time data about where the air quality was good or bad, and you'd be able to track sources and things like that. We really don't have that, and we should. And this might, if we're lucky, this will be a start to an expectation that we will monitor air quality, sound levels, all these kinds of things all the time. The technology exists. We just have been reluctant to spend the money, I think maybe because we're afraid of what we might find.
And then in terms of environmental impacts of the inland port, I mean, this is establishing a baseline and learning about what's being done. But then, you know, what if we find out that it's terrible?
Well, exactly. I mean, it may be a lot of I told you so's, and that'll be it. I mean, the big concern about the state rushing in and creating this authority to develop this land as an inland port, taking it away from the city, I don't think there's any rational conclusion other than that they were afraid that the city would care more about the environment than the state will. I mean, the city is run by these Democrats, and they tree huggers, and they will limit pollution. They will care about pollution, whereas the state doesn't because it smells like money. So that's the concern. I mean, but also this is brand new, so there is some hope that with brand new technology and electric trains and electric switch engines and things like that, we could create a port, a transit area that is pretty green if we want to.
We're going to have to leave it there because we're at the point of the show where we have to turn to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And, George, maybe I'll stick with you. Do you have a pick for underplayed story?
Well, it's kind of hard to understand how 102 earthquakes could be underplayed. But apparently there have been a lot, they've been measuring these, and these are the kinds of things that are beneath the perception of normal people, but people who – we do have monitoring equipment for earthquakes.
Right.
And apparently down around Bluffdale, we've been having a bunch of them recently. They 3.2 on the Richter scale, and which is not that bad. And they're saying, well, what does this mean? And they're saying, well, it means we had an earthquake. It doesn't mean that we're about to have the big one.
Or that it's relieving pressure, apparently.
Or that it's relieving pressure. Or that it doesn't mean that we're not about to have the big one. It's just kind of this little reminder that we live in a place. You know, I live right across the street from Fault Line Gardens. I don't know if that's how attractive that is.
But well, be careful up there, George. Taylor Stevens, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, really quick. There are two cities in Utah that have passed some ordinances that would up the age where you can buy tobacco from 19 to 21. There's also a move on the state level that's looking to do something similar, and it has kind of a surprising opponent, the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Check out the story. SLTrib.com to see why Wish I had more time.
It's really interesting. They're saying, hey, we don't want to raise the age limit, or there's a lot of complications there. Check it out at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Many people would think that every police officer carries a body camera. And in Salt Lake County's Unified Police Force, that's not the case. Only 30% do. And they're thinking about even getting rid of that. They say it costs too much money and they're worried about the budget. And so they might scrap body cameras altogether, which has some activists very concerned. Salt Lake City Police, they're not even going to consider it. There, the police officers like the body cameras. They look at it as protection of their actions, proof that they did the right thing.
In Salt Lake City, is it that all police officers wear body cameras?
In Salt Lake City, all police officers have.
That's an interesting story. Check it out at sltrib.com. Just quickly, Matt, who is proposing doing away with body cams?
It'd be the Unified Police Department, which is a big part of Salt Lake County.
Okay. For my part, for Underplayed Story, I'm going to go with House Bill 220, the bill that would allow the storage of depleted uranium in Utah. It's a low-level radioactive material that grows more hazardous over time. That storage would be done by Energy Solutions, the radioactive waste storage company. And to quote Tony Semerad's article in the Tribune, many of the bill's vocal supporters are recipients of Energy Solutions' campaign contributions, while not a single one of the senators opposing it took such donations. You can find that article and all of the articles that we've been talking about today at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, George Pyle, and Taylor Stevens, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us today on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan for their help. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. On Twitter, we are at KCPW. I'm at Roger McDonough. You can also find us on Facebook and elsewhere. Have a great weekend, and thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week.